Hello and welcome to the Food Engineering Podcast. I'm Editor-in-Chief Derek Teal. Today I'm joined by Jeff Roy, Senior VP of Manufacturing for McCown Gordon, a Kansas City-based construction firm. In this episode, Jeff is sharing his insight regarding what the food and beverage industry can expect in 2024.
So I guess we'll just, you know, dive right into it. Jeff, thanks for joining me. And regarding economic signs like inflation, high raw material costs, et cetera, what do you see happening in 2024?
I think happy to be here. And I think with respect to the items you had just mentioned, we are seeing the inflation is starting to flatten out and the cost certainty is a little more predictable, which is what the clients are looking for, but it's allowing our pre-con and estimating teams to be more accurate earlier, and which gives obviously the higher degree of cost certainty for the owners and allows them to do that. We're able to move forward with projects more based on the enhanced knowledge that we have. A lot of the bigger concerns around that or with the costs is primarily still around the labor shortages are the biggest concern moving into next year as far as the economic signs go. Labor shortage, not only is there an engineering shortage on the design side, but the actual skilled labor is still the biggest concern. And there's so many large mega projects, pick dollar value, 100 million and above or 200 million and above, these type of contractor, you can't always use smaller local contractors. So finding the appropriate skilled trade labor and bringing them in from out of town without intentionally adding unnecessary cost premiums, those are the biggest things that are going to continue for the next few years in our eyes.
Yeah, and talking about the labor issues, these were issues that started prior to the pandemic too. I know the pandemic didn't help anything, but these issues started before the pandemic, right?
They did. They started, and a lot of it has been, we've been in a boom for the last 3 to 5 years prior to the pandemic of large scale major mega projects. And those are where the big drawing factors are. And a lot of the union contractors in the regions, they're busy. They don't have enough people. And even the non-union and the open shop that have adequate training and apprenticeship programs, they're just not turning out enough qualified skilled labor to meet the job demands, even when you mix them together. So the qualified skilled trades is the biggest challenge for all the projects that we see over the next 2 years at least.
Do you think that these labor issues are exacerbated by in the food and beverage industry where there it's such a specialized area in manufacturing, or do you think that it's across the board?
I think it's across the board. Your mechanical and electrical, it's exacerbated because of the specialized knowledge, clean design, sanitary standards, and things like that. It's easier on the architectural elements or the building box components, but when you get into the mechanical systems and the electrical systems, how those are merged and married together, those clean conduit isn't always conduit, and interstitial space becomes process space and washdown. When you get into class and div rated spaces, that's where the specialized industry knowledge comes from, and there always has to be somebody's first project doing that. But a lot of clients are reluctant. They like the price, but once they understand that this company doesn't do this other than once a year, and now that business is slow, they're looking. Everybody wants to get into food and beverage and manufacturing because it appears to be sexy, but there's specialized knowledge that, you know, the top 10 contractors or top 20, there's a reason we do what we do every year, year round.
Yeah, and talking about things being slow, so companies are looking to get into the food and beverage space. We've seen that last year in one of our studies, we saw that profit margins generally weren't where they'd been for food and beverage manufacturers in the past, that they were making money, but their margins were really narrow because of increased costs. But they're taking what money they did have, what profit they did make, and reinvest it in their facilities. Do you see that continuing to happen?
The facility and reinvestment?
Yes.
Yeah, that's where a lot of it is. Over the last, pre-pandemic, and then since then, let's say over the prior 3 or 4 years, and for the next 3 to 5 years, we see a lot of infrastructure and facilities work because the bones of the plants are just getting aged and it's time to upgrade. And with that upgrade comes a potential expansion or a retrofit of the process or the packaging side of things. But the infrastructures and the utilities are just getting aged and it's time to deal with them in replacements rather than Band-Aids. Everybody is looking for their what's next, and as skilled and unskilled companies and contractors try to dabble, there's a concern to make sure owners do the proper vetting of the contractors and the design companies, that there's a little more knowledge needed to specialize expertise than building a strip center or building a commercial office building, those type of things. You take all of those plus the food manufacturing or the beverage side of things, it's a little more complicated and a little more thought out. And I think we want to guard against that as ethically as we can as people that specialize in that. But with the lack of labor and the people, like we talked on the owner side, we also have owners who are trying to execute projects themselves. And they may have engineering groups and they may have project managers, but we're seeing more and more of that to try to save a nickel when it's going to end up costing them thousands or millions of dollars more in perceived markup or fees if they do it themselves. And they're great at manufacturing chocolate, at chips, at beer. They're not good at executing projects per se. Now, I don't mean that as an insult. It's just they're experts at making what that is. We're experts at designing and building their facilities to get them to the point that they can make what they make. And that still holds true. That's still going to be present and prevalent.
Right, because you'll get a food manufacturer that maybe throughout an individual's career at said manufacturer, if they stayed there for an entire career, maybe they build one or two buildings, where this is something you're doing constantly.
Every day. Correct. Or they may run a line and they may be a production supervisor or an engineering manager, but it's centered around the engineering of the actual manufacturing process. It's not dealing with the line speeds, the sanitary standards. They know because they see it every day, but to go out and do that and actually integrate all the different trades and subcontractors and equipment vendors, there's a lot that goes into executing food and beverage projects that not everybody is aware of or thinks about.
And you mentioned the infrastructure. Is that where you expect the majority of food and beverage manufacturers to reinvest, or are there other places within the facility that you expect them to reinvest?
I think the infrastructure, inclusive of the utilities, is going to be a heavy focus, as well as the process and the packaging, with the seeking out or the desire to automate more there. That's causing some changes. Is that going to impact their infrastructure and utilities? Absolutely. Can they take out lines and put out more automated systems in? Yes. But none of our clients are really contracting. They're expanding. They don't have enough space to meet the demands. And when you throw the consumer confidence in, not necessarily confidence, but the desire to still eat and drink, with the influx of onshoring or reshoring, where the global clients realize as a result of the supply chain issues through the pandemic, they need to bring things back and establish those manufacturing facilities back into the US or in addition to. So it's really a global operation, but in order to control their own destiny and meet their own demands, they have to be able to manufacture those products here in the continental US.
And you brought up supply chain. Do you see that affecting anything? Because I know that initially when we had supply chain issues, it was on the construction side with the, you know, raw materials, so to speak, and then it became machinery. Do you see that still affecting things?
It is. There's still mechanical and electrical components are still a big concern. Most of your roofing material at the start of the pandemic and at the end of the pandemic was a big long lead item. That's caught itself up. IMP panels are big in the food and beverage world. That's caught itself back up. The primary long lead equipment is your electrical gear and components, transformers from the utility companies themselves are a very long lead item. And we all know how hard it is to work with utility companies themselves to get transformers. But switchgear, MCCs, those are still long lead items because there's still some residual effects of chip availability and things like that. And then large capacity chillers and rooftop units and things are still longer lead item. They're slowly coming down, but nowhere near what they were pre-pandemic.
And are there any type of facility investments that you would say, no, you don't want to do that in 2024? Is there anything where you advise? You know, we talked about, you know, automation and maybe not having enough room to do something in that realm. But are there any places where you say, yeah, you know, maybe put that off a little bit?
I think the office space and the office expansion is it's a catch-22 for the clients. In their quest for automation, like we talked, in the facilities and the infrastructure, age is age, systems are systems. They have to do that. The automation is one that is still a hot button and a desire because of the lack of qualified workforce and them attracting people to want to come to work. They've got open office space. They've got unused office space and locker rooms. However, in order to attract, it's a very fine line of renovating and expanding or improving your employee or associate amenities. That's one of the areas that I don't ever want to discourage at the risk of having a client not do a project and costing us revenue. But at the same time, there's a lot more focus around training facilities and expansion and updating office, updating locker rooms, updating. They want to do the maintenance and not the retrofits and the enhancements unless they know they're going to be able to attract the requisite labor they need, which ties back into the automation. So it's trying to understand their whole capital plan rather than just a specific process or package need. It ties back into the facility, but I think there's more questions that need to be asked on the benefit and what their ROI is when you get into the amenity side of things.
Right. We see a lot of new facilities going up that they pay particular attention to the manufacturing floor itself, like making sure there's, you know, something like natural light or open space just to get away from that older, cramped, dimly lit sort of manufacturing space that, as you know, that some of the older facilities have to deal with.
Right. It's the government regulations or the sustainability hopes and dreams that clients and global clients in particular have. Some of those improvements, they want to make them, and then they end up not doing them because they're cost prohibitive. And they always will default to go focus what's inside the box on the manufacturing floor because that's what makes them money.
And you know, we've been talking about automation as a way of helping to deal with the labor issues that are affecting many manufacturers. When it comes to automation, where would you say money is best spent to put automation in first?
Probably downstream if you go from the palletizing and work your way upstream. So palletizing, case packing, those type of things where it's heavy manual labor, the risk potential for worker injury is there. You've got fork trucks that are in the way and the greatest risk there. And then work your way upstream through. Obviously, a lot of the lines are semi-automated or automated to a point, but then depending on the process, whether it's a food or a beverage, the process is automated. You don't have people mixing batches per se as much anymore. But ideally, it's the warehousing and it's the palletizing. It's the downstream from your packing and packaging is the primary areas to focus on.
Generally, not only the most grueling of the jobs in a manufacturing environment, but also the most, they're the least mentally engaging.
They are. And they're the first ones that get injured and hurt. It's too easy to get distracted. They're not always the best lit. There's dark warehouses that are gaining more and more popularity because of the automation and the level of robots and automated vehicles. They don't need light. So it's trying to balance that. But the ROI window is a lot greater because the owners are having a difficult time attracting labor. So the owners are forced to start automating their processes and systems because they can't find labor.
And we talked a little bit about this earlier, but do you foresee any upcoming regulations affecting how or why food and beverage manufacturers spend their money?
I think it's a continuation still, Derek. On years ago when Homeland Defense and they started the food safety and defense plans, people were looking at ways to get in and infiltrate plants. What are code requirements? We've had architects work on maximizing egress distances and minimizing and locking off doors that would traditionally be exit-only doors, but you may have to remove door hardware. That's one less way for somebody to get in and contaminate the food supply. I think that still continues on because, again, you have aging facilities. And when you have newer ones, you've got newer requirements that become default. You just design it because you know. It's the older ones. There's new government regulations coming out being implemented around food labels and labeling requirements. That's going to trigger packaging and labeling projects within the floor, the manufacturing floor. So there'll be line retrofits and other retrofits, no different than an owner changing a bottle size where it affects your conveyors and your case packer and your labeler, et cetera. Labels are labels. And do they have to change the bottle? How do they rework those? So I see that is an investment that owners are going to have to take a look at in how to stay in compliance.
And talking about labels, the other people who see those are the consumers. And they, in recent years, have been trending toward, you know, snacking instead of meals, and particularly with the healthy snacks and health foods, or foods that they feel are healthy in general, that sort of kicked off at the pandemic when people started cooking their own foods. What do you see happening in that realm with the consumers in terms of their consumption habits?
I think if you throw in people's pets as consumers as well, not just humans, but the pets, we all see how much the premium pet food industry has grown, and that is snacks, as well as primary meals and regular traditional pet food, with the advent of that. And the pandemic has brought that out, and that's going to continue forward. The pet food industry and the pet snacks is growing exponentially. But the other companies are looking at these premium products and that, and they're still planning to grow. And part of their growth now is not only in their product development, but it's acquisition. They're looking, that is still going to happen and is still happening today. And I expect that to happen for the next, you know, many years to come, growth by acquisition rather than strict product development.
Right. Yeah. We've been seeing that mergers and acquisitions for years now in the space, that, you know, that's how companies have been growing. Like you say, it's easier to acquire than it is to spend the money to develop a product on your own that might or might not catch on with consumers. So finding something right. That's tried and true.
Yeah, it's similar to like we do. If we would go into a growth mode where we're looking at acquisition, you expect to be able to buy a book of business. And with food companies or beverage companies, you're almost buying a book of business through consumers because you know it's an established. When Mars purchased Kind Bars, and went through those type of situations and those acquisitions, you're buying a book of business, which is us as consumers, because it's established. And that's a big part of that. And that alone spurs and triggers projects as well, because of that. So we're okay with all of those growth modes and the acquisitions, but I still see that moving forward.
And generally speaking, what are your overall expectations for the upcoming year?
We've got very high expectations. We've got some pretty ambitious goals. We've got clients who have expressed their ambitions and goals moving into 2024 and beyond, helping them figure out how far into the future really is. But we've got some pretty high expectations, goals, and aspirations that we see continuing for the next at least 3 to 5 years. Barring any other pandemic or any other force majeure event type of thing, I think everybody has learned how to deal with those as they come and what to expect and how to do things. And we successfully navigated the first pandemic and were able to have a record year and to get things built safely. But I think it's going to continue for the next several years. So we've got real high hopes and goals and dreams and everything else.
That's great, Jeff. Thanks again for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it.
No, anytime. Love to help and look forward to doing more of this with you, Derek.
That's going to do it for this Food Engineering Podcast. I'd like to once again thank my guest, Jeff Roy of McCown Gordon. You can learn more about McCown Gordon at McCownGordon.com. That's McCownGordon.com. For more Food Engineering Podcasts, articles, news, products, and videos, visit foodengineeringmag.com. Thanks for listening.